You say you did it. I say you didn't. You say you worked hard. I say so did I. You say you worked hard. I say so did I. I say you got lucky. You say I didn't try. So you say it all worked. I say not for me. You say I didn't try. I say you just don't see why. You say I didn't try. I ask, can't you cry? You ask, why should I? I ask as I sigh. Why can't you see it? If we exist as I, too few will make it if we are only I. Folks, that's the whole question in life is how much do we care about others and how much do we sacrifice a little bit to make our world a better place? We're going to talk about all kinds of issues on this show. This is the Lehigh Valley Discourse on WDIY, and I'm your host, Alan Jennings.
Reporters aren't accustomed to being on the subject side of an interview. And yet, reporters play an extraordinarily important role in our democracy. They expose us. They challenge us. They reflect us. They read us back to ourselves. I've been in the public eye for most of my adult life, and I've met many, many reporters. Dozens, certainly, maybe in excess of 100. They are rarely homegrown here in the Lehigh Valley. They come from somewhere else. They hang around until they can get a gig at the Philadelphia Inquirer, the Newark Star-Ledger, Newsday, and they're gone. Some move on because the business is shrinking. Some stick around. They settle in. Almost every reporter I have met is smart, capable of becoming an expert on any subject matter within minutes. Most are pretty cynical. Many want to get the bastards. One particularly interesting guy is a court reporter for the Morning Call. He covers ugly stuff. Like a nurse in a burn trauma unit, he sees some pretty nasty stuff, the kind of stuff that will test your liberalism or spend your store of empathy. I'm Alan Jennings, and I'm your host for tonight's edition of Lehigh Valley Discourse on WDIY, Lehigh Valley Public Radio. Many choices, real voices. With me tonight is Riley Yates. Riley's been at the Morning Call for more than 10 years. He reminds me of the guy who played, ironically enough, Riley on National Treasure. Riley Yates, welcome to Lehigh Valley Discourse.
Well, thanks for having me.
So, you know, I know some things about you, and they're fascinating. And I want to start with the question of, did you tell your parents that you were going to be doing the show? Is there any possibility they're listening?
I did tell them, and I think they probably will look it up and try to watch it.
You want to do a shout-out to Mom and Dad?
Yeah, hi Mom, hi Dad, hi Emily.
So the your mother, I understand, is in Seattle, but your father is in a rather remote place.
Yeah, he was. He's now actually in Eugene, Oregon. So he moved down to what we call the lower 48.
So when did that happen? How long has he been continental?
He's been continental since after I was in high school.
So he was in a fishing village? Was he a fisherman?
Yeah, I grew up in southeast Alaska, which is it's the panhandle of Alaska, which if you picture the face that is Alaska, there are islands that run down alongside British Columbia. Mm-hmm. And so if you think about Alaska as like barren, 40 below, midnight sun, it's not really that kind of Alaska. It's actually more like you to picture the Pacific Northwest. It's very
Twin Peaks.
Very, very lush. It's rainy. You know, you have in the summer, the high temperatures are probably in the 70s. Maybe if you're really lucky, you have a day in the 80s. Huh. In the winter, it's probably in the 20s.
We went to Alaska for our 20th wedding anniversary, my wife and I, and absolutely loved the place. But you know, we went to all the places you expect to go. So the cruise ships, did you have to watch cruise ships going by every
day?
Yeah,
every once in a while they'd come through. The ferry. I mean, Alaska's a weird place in that you're not really connected by roads. You're connected by planes and you're connected by boats.
So my understanding is the house you lived in, your father built himself.
Yeah, it was... Petersburg is the town I'm from. It's 3,000 people, 1,800 in the winter because everybody flees. And we actually lived on the island next door, which was an island called Kupernov. And we were essentially totally off the grid. No electricity, no running water, no plumbing, no television. You know, my dad eventually set up pipes so that we could essentially get water from the bog up the
no
way.
Kidding. And this during is the like winter, the 21st, haul, I mean,
during the winter,
century.
We'd haul well. Yeah, so I was born in 81, so this was, you know, through the 80s and 90s.
Wow. So do you know Jewel?
I do not know Jewel. I get asked that a lot. And then more recently, Sarah Palin.
Yeah, well, that's a good one, too, although I think I'd rather meet Jewel. So I grew up in Larimer County Township. I took a school bus to school. Was there a school on the island where you lived?
Petersburg has a school, yeah, and we took a school boat. But that said, most of my schooling was in Seattle because when I was six, my parents split up and I lived most of the year in Seattle. And then 4 months a year, I would essentially, as soon as there was a vacation, the next day I'd be on the plane and going up to Alaska to see my dad.
You're listening to WDOI, Lehigh Valley Public Radio, Many Choices, Real Voices. So how do you get along in life as a kid without television, for example? Or I mean, how does that affect you?
Well, it's funny because—
You don't know what you're missing?
Kids are naturally adaptable, but there are certain things like I could build a fire before I can remember— You know, learning to build a fire. We carried matches with us as little kids. We used kerosene lanterns, and as a kid, I could light my own kerosene lantern. I hauled water from the nearby stream for drinking water. If we took a bath, we would have to. When I was little, we'd have to boil water on our propane stove, carry it downstairs, and then dump it into the bathtub and then add enough cold water to make a bath.
So instead of watching television, what were you doing? Reading?
Well, so the thing about life like that is you spend a lot of your time just sort of existing. So, you know, and as a kid, it's kind of ameliorated by the fact you have adults doing a lot of this stuff. But, you know, my dad spent most of his free time, it was about you know, setting up life so that you could live. So we had two caches of firewood that we'd have to fill every summer to make it through the winter.
So you heated your house with wood burning stove. Wow.
Yeah. I can remember, you know, you'd have these cold days and you'd be miserable and it'd be raining and you'd get off the boat from coming into town and we'd get onto the shore and you'd make it up to the log cabin and you'd open the door and you'd have this huge blast of heat. And I can always just remember as a kid how good that felt.
And you were wet a lot, I guess.
Yeah, I always tell people my strongest memory as a kid is being soaking wet and just being wet all the time. Because, you know, Petersburg's a place where you can have, you have maybe 3 weeks of sunshine the whole year.
Brutal.
And when you're talking about in you know, we were kind of lucky in the sense that we came on in the summer, we came on Christmas time when we'd have the sort of amazing sort of textbook Christmas, you know, Christmas card existence, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, September in Petersburg, you can have these huge, big waves and it's just pouring down rain. It's dark the whole time. It can be a really tough life.
Yeah, when I was in Alaska, it was May, and so I don't think the sun ever really fully set.
Yeah.
But so the converse to that would be the sun never really rising, right?
Yeah, I mean, we don't have, you know, we're way south of the Arctic Circle,
right? That's right. You aren't up.
But in the summer, you know, we would, my dad was a fisherman, and during the summer I worked on his crab fishing boat, Dungeness crab fishing boat. And, you know, you'd have days that would could start at, like, the sun could rise at 4:30, and you'd be working maybe until 10:30.
Wow.
You know, the days are certainly longer.
So your parents separate. Your mom flees to Seattle. You go from one of the most primitive places in the country to arguably the most civilized. What is that? I mean, how was the adjustment?
You know, the The thing about it is, I think you do see, like as I mentioned, kids are so adaptable. I can remember vividly my first day of first grade in Seattle. And I can remember.
I remember my first day of first grade. My teacher yanked my hair because I was goofing off during the national anthem.
Okay. Well, I can remember seeing all these kids, and they were all interacting. They probably had been to school before, and I can remember thinking, "I'm never going to fit in."
Did you?
And you know, I've always marched to my own drummer, and so. Yeah, I think I've never felt downcast because I was from Alaska. I've always felt really fortunate because, you know, there's things that we got to do in Alaska that we had bald eagles that flew, you know, that nested in the, in the neighbors right next to our neighbor, and they would call them down. They would bring out fish and they would call, and the bald eagles would come down and pick up these fish.
Holy cow.
We could walk to a stream where during the summer we could catch salmon with our hands at low tide.
Like a bear.
Yeah.
Wow. Well,
you know, so there were a lot of things that were just, there were a lot of things that it also taught you to be tough because, you know, the reality is it's you know, the expectation of you as a kid at 6, 7, 8 in the middle of nowhere is a lot greater than maybe if you were, you know, with a helicopter parent in the suburbs.
So is there any application of that upbringing to what you do as a reporter? I mean, you obviously came to this job with a very, very different different life than any of your peers. Does it impact the way you look at your job in any way?
Well, I think the biggest thing with me, the thing that I really like about just my family in general is my family's a lot of hard workers, and being a kid in Alaska really taught me about hard work, and it taught me about how you get something done as you start it, and you work at it till you finish it, and I think that that's probably, as a reporter, what it's helped. You know, it's everybody has their strengths and everybody has to use their strengths. And I don't consider myself like the most charismatic person. I don't consider myself the most socially adept person. But I think I work hard, and I think that that maybe makes up for it.
Does that lifestyle create liberals or conservatives?
Probably both, honestly. I mean, there's a lot of people in Alaska who are conservative. There's a lot of people who...
Conservative because, you know, I don't need any help. I can make it on my own.
Well, sure, there's that. I mean, but there's also, if you think about it, Alaska's a huge place, right? And there's constant reminders of nature and of the bountifulness of nature, right? When you talk... And you have... Most people are living off of the bountifulness of nature. They're fishermen, they're loggers, they're working up in the oil industry, right? And so there's an interesting perspective from that lifestyle to the lifestyle of the city where you see nature being lacking, right? And that leads to a different perspective. I can remember being at a dinner party where a guy read about, he was talking about overpopulation, and he was reading for something, and he was talking about how New York City, how many people lived in New York City, and he was saying, see, there's no problem with overpopulation, right? And this is a guy, of course, who lives in the middle of nowhere, and if he were to go to New York City, he would probably find it to be terribly overpopulated, right?
Yeah, I'm always amazed to go to New York and that it even works. I mean, it's just such a mass of people and infrastructure and buildings and stuff. I don't know how the hell it works.
And, of course, it's not self-sufficient, right? It works because there are other places that are more rural.
Yeah. At what point in your life did you decide to pursue a career in a dying industry?
it's funny you say that because I actually thought when I decided to become a journalist that it was a practical craft because
who knew?
Because I was I was an English major and I studied it was kind of a fluke that I became a journalist. I was about to graduate. I'd taken all these English classes and I looked at, you know, how many credits I had and I had enough credits for another major. And so I looked around and I thought, well, I might as well get something practical that I actually could use. And so I like to write, I like to read, and so I became a journalist. And what sealed the deal there was when I was, I remember the thing where I thought, wow, this is amazing, was I interviewed a professor who'd done work on the hydrogen bomb. And I got to talk to him about, you know, what his view of his contribution or his view of his role or how he felt about having contributed to that. And I just remember thinking it was so impressive to me that, because I'm not a person who would seek, I would, in my day-to-day life, I would not seek out that person. I certainly, if I were to meet them at a dinner party, I wouldn't talk to them about that subject. You know, I thought about how interesting it was that journalists get this opportunity to ask people, you know, about their own specialties and to ask probing questions about it and not be considered like a social pariah.
All right. And so now your beat at the morning call is covering Northampton County Courts. You're moving on from that beat, but that's really the key question for me today is getting into your experience
sure.
in the Northampton County court system. When you're a reporter and you cover something that really can be about the ugliest of the underbelly of our society, what do good or bad news look like?
Well, it's funny you mention that because I can remember having a professor at the University of Washington who was a cops reporter in Detroit. And he said that he quit doing that because he started to talk like a cop. And what he meant was he said, I started to say, oh, this was a good murder or this was a bad murder. And what he meant was like, this was a murder that will get me on the front page or this is a murder that will be buried inside the paper. And he decided that he couldn't do that. He didn't want to be that kind of person. And that's a battle that you have because you see a lot of bad stuff and you write about, you know, everybody at their worst moment. And it's really hard not to become jaded to that. And you have to remember that for each of those people, for all the people involved, that's life, right? That's the most important thing. And it takes a lot of energy to keep that up. And, you know, having done it for 10 years, you know, is it a defendant apologizing to his victim's family? I've seen that 100 times. A victim's family crying, I've seen that 100 times. And I don't mean to dismiss
trivialize
that,
it, sure.
But it's just that's just the reality of my experience. And so it requires kind of a lot of reassessment every once in a while to say, you know, treat this like it should be treated.
You're listening to Lehigh Valley Discourse on WDIY, Lehigh Valley Public Radio, Many Choices, Real Voices. I'm your host, Alan Jennings. My guest this evening is Riley Yates, a reporter from the Morning Call, who has been covering the Northampton County courts for some time. Riley's a particularly fascinating guy because of his upbringing and some of other aspects of his life we haven't gotten into. But we're going to get into the darkest and deepest elements of the human condition as we continue with the show. So we're just going to take a quick break. Stick around. We'll be right back.
The Many Choices and Real Voices on WDIY are made possible with support from our generous, sustaining members. An automatic monthly gift of $10 on your credit card is an easy way to become a WDIY member and support the programs you love. Set up your monthly sustaining membership gift today. Call 610-694-8100 extension 7 or visit wdiy.org. Thank you.
Welcome back. This is Alan Jennings, your host for Lehigh Valley Discourse this evening on WDIY, Lehigh Valley Public Radio, Many Choices, Real Voices. My guest tonight is Riley Yates. I'm turning the tables on this poor guy. As a reporter, he's usually the one doing the questioning. Tonight I get to do it. Joseph Conrad famously coined the term fascination with the abomination. Sort of that I can't look while being unable to avert your eyes kind of thing. You know, you You know, you don't want to see it, but you can't help but see it. And, you know, sometimes you have gruesome elements of a trial where the jurors aren't expected to even look, and you somehow find yourself looking. I don't want to be a figurative voyeur by asking, but how do you deal with the elements of your work that could cause PTSD, you know, post-traumatic stress disorder, for even the toughest among us? I mean, I get that you were, you know, raised in a fishing village, I suppose, that makes you tough, as you said. But, I mean, this is tough, tough stuff to watch and to be a part of and to reflect on. And so how do you do it?
Well, it's certainly difficult. And, you know, it's the irony is that I'm not even someone who necessarily likes the crime genre. I it's not like I watch, you know, whodunit TV cop shows or whatever.
Right.
I don't watch the courtroom drama. I do it because it's my job, and I feel that it's, you know, required to be able to tell the story. And you know, unfortunately, these horrors are part of the story. And, you know, there's, I mean, to give an example, I covered the trial of Gregory Graff, who was a guy who murdered his stepdaughter, hid her body, or murdered his stepdaughter, had sex with her corpse, and filmed it. And part of the evidence, God, of course, was this video. And so you had this strange scene in the courtroom where they set up this screen to prevent anyone but the jurors from seeing it. But of course, us as the media, that's part of the story. We sit on the other side of the screen and we see it like everyone else. And so, you know, there's no other way to describe it than just horror. It's, you know, it's horrible. It's unspeakable. It's indescribable. But it's something that, you know, certainly it'll be with me. You know, those are things that I carry. I think about Michael Ballard, a mass murderer, killed four people in a house in Northampton. The crime scene photos there were the worst things I've ever seen, and those haunt me.
Do you have nightmares?
I've had one nightmare once where I woke up like screaming, and it was over Ballard, and he was in the house, and I realized that it wasn't even that he was threatening us. He was just in the house, and I realized my children were there, and I thought, oh, my God, what am I going to do? And woke up. But, no, I mean, I'm sure it's affected me, and, you know, my family might have a better, more insight into how it's affected me. But it's the other thing that I remind myself is, however it's affected me, it's not anywhere near how it's affected the people who lived through it. It's not any, you know, nobody feels sorry for me. I'm a reporter who's just doing my job. You know, I think about the cops who had to go into the homes. I think about the coroners who had to, and forget about, you know, the victims' families, right, who have to live with that every day. And so I can't, you know, dwell on it too much. You can't really have a pity party over it.
Hmm. On March 11th, the NAACP is working. We're helping the NAACP, my agency, the Community Action Committee of Lehigh Valley, is holding a forum called "The Color of Justice," and the idea is to raise questions about the disparity in the justice system between white and minority individuals. And Josh Shapiro, the Pennsylvania Attorney General, is going to be keynote. President Judge in Lehigh County, Ed Reedman, will talk. Craig Daly, who's done some creative things with the courts in Northampton County, will also talk, along with a few others. And, you know, we want to get into issues like bail and reentry and incarceration and so on. And I'm wondering, you know, whether, you know, from your perspective, does our criminal justice system work?
I mean, it's interesting in my evolution of covering the courts, because I would say when I first started covering the courts, I would have said, yes, it does. And I would say that as I've covered it more, I've probably become more jaundiced about that. I think you have a lot of well-meaning people in the courts, and I don't necessarily agree with the criticism of, you know, that prosecutors are just out to win convictions and defense lawyers are incompetent. And, you know, that I think it's more nuanced than that. The thing I would say on the good side is that having covered dozens of trials, I can't think of a trial where I've thought, oh my God, the jury, you know, really messed it up. I've seen people who I thought were guilty maybe get acquitted, and I've seen people who were very guilty get convicted of something less maybe than they actually did. But you do see that the jury thinks about it, and they do. I haven't had like an O.J. Simpson verdict or right. anything like that. The thing I would say what I always find the most troubling with the courts isn't in the major cases, in the murder cases or in the death penalty cases. It's in the minor cases where the system just doesn't really care enough about the cases. And I think mm-hmm. you see this a lot. If you get in a bar fight and you punch somebody and you get charged with simple assault, to the prosecutor, to the defense lawyer, to the judge, it's just another case that needs to get done. And what you see is you see there's that approach versus the reality to that person, which is that conviction could cause them to lose their job, could cause them, their home to go into foreclosure, could cause their marriage to fall apart. And the collateral consequences to those cases can be absolutely enormous. And even like minor things like the fees that are tacked on to the case could be insurmountable to a defendant. And what you see is you see a lot, the system just isn't really set up to pay attention to all those things because, you know, it is just a minor case. And from the perspective of everybody involved, it isn't a big deal. And, you know, that's true even with the newspaper. We don't tend to write about those cases. You know, it's just part of the churning of the courts.
You're listening to, this is Riley Yates on Lehigh Valley Discourse with me, Alan Jennings, your host on WDIY. Riley is is leaving his position and concentrating on the Northampton County Court beat, and he has seen some of the ugliest aspects of our world. I'm wondering, what do you see that's like actually makes you feel good about your community, about the human condition? Do you ever get anything that makes you like walk out of the courtroom and say, damn, I'm glad I went to this case? Or
yeah, I mean, you do. There are certainly cases that I can think of that where I was really impressed by the people involved. And, you know, and the places I would say that I've really to speak to what you're talking about, where I've been sort of touched, are often when you have victims of difficult or really awful crimes who still find a way to be strong and to persevere and still find a way to have perspective. And I think about like one case, for instance, I covered was a woman who, she left her baby at a daycare. The first day of the daycare, the baby died of sudden infant death syndrome.
Oh, God.
And they charged the daycare owner with neglecting the baby because of the crib she used was placed in a place where she couldn't monitor the baby regularly. And poor substandard care. And this woman came into court at this, the owner's sentencing, and she said, you're as much of a victim as I am, and I feel bad for you. I feel bad that you have to live with what happened. And I love my daughter, but I understand that you didn't mean to kill her. And there was something about her level of forgiveness there and her ability to, you know, try to make something good out of this absolutely awful occurrence that was pretty incredible. And, you know, you don't see that very often. And you know, you could also, as a parent myself, I don't know if I would have that reaction.
Yeah, that would be tough. And You know, I'm not a particularly forgiving person, and whenever I see that, I read that or watch it on news accounts, I'm always amazed. I don't know if I would ever be able to forgive. I just carry grudges as it is. I still hate the Mets from 1969 World Series, you know? And, I mean, I don't want to trivialize this, but yeah. I mean, you know, if I can't get over that, I can't imagine getting over the kind of things that you're seeing in the courtroom. So what about disparity? Do you see differences? I mean, do you think that people of color are treated, you know, better or worse than people who are white?
Well, you know, a colleague of mine, Steve Essek, and I, a couple of years ago, did a story about the response to the opiate epidemic mm-hmm. versus the response to the crack epidemic.
Yeah, that's a good one.
And, you know, it's obvious that there was a different response, right?
Right.
When it was with crack and a largely black community, it was lock them up and throw away the key.
Right.
It was, you know, the driving mantra was incarceration. With the heroin epidemic, which has touched the suburbs, or which has touched the suburbs, it's been, the message has been treatment, and the message has been let's avoid stigmatizing these folks.
Right.
And but there's a couple ways of looking at that. One way is to say that there's racism there, right? Another way to say in a lot of the people who once supported these mandatory minimums and all the things that led to all the reaction to the crack epidemic became reformers because they said, look, we tried something and we realized it didn't work. And that may speak less to racism and more to you know, the evolution of thinking. That's kind of a judgment call that isn't mine to make.
But and the effect, and anyway, still is a disparate effect,
sure.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, even with marijuana versus, I mean, I've always felt that marijuana was nowhere near as dangerous to our society as alcohol is. Alcohol is just fine. We celebrate it like it's the most important thing in some people's lives. While marijuana, we've got jails full of people. I mean, I think they ought to just open the jails. Anybody who was convicted of a marijuana offense should have their sentence commuted. But marijuana was, you know, quote, a minority issue, you know, in the early years. And so, you know, we treat it like it's LSD for crying out loud, and that's ridiculous. But those are the kind of effect kinds of things that you get by practices or policies that are maybe not intended to get one group over another, but have the effect of that. And what about bail? You've written about bail.
Yeah, you know, it's a very interesting issue because it's kind of, you know, there's a few different kind of cutting-edge issues, and bail reform is one of them. Probation reform is another one. That was with Meek Mill down in Philadelphia, and this and the perception that he was treated badly, getting in trouble, or getting sent to state prison for essentially technical probation violations. Mm-hmm. But bail is a really interesting issue, and Northampton County's tried to tackle that, where they're trying this sort of pilot program where the more minor charges are going to be let out on bail to avoid incarcerating people, because there's a lot of studies that suggest that even like a day or two of incarceration can have a lot of really bad impacts on people. And the general thinking is, well, if you're innocent until proven guilty, you shouldn't sit in jail waiting for your case to resolve. And you certainly have cases where, you know, someone will sit in jail longer than the sentence that they might get by pleading guilty. And that can raise questions about, well, then are they just pleading guilty to get out of jail, and is that fair?
You also did was it a series, or was it just one story where you reported on death row and you actually visited death row and walked those what have to be dark, dingy hallways and let's talk about
it was 2012, I believe. And I think the Department of Corrections said I was the first reporter to be permitted to tour it. We weren't 100% sure if that was the case, but
where was this? At Greaterford?
This is in Greene, which is about as close to West Virginia as you can get. So okay. It's completely across the other side of the state, and that's the main death row. There's also one in Greaterford, but it's a it's hard to even describe. It's a very stark place. It's, you know, the idea of sitting 22 hours a day in a cell. And the thing that jumped out to me was everything they do is in a cage. So if you go to, they have rec time, which is literally they go in onto a piece of a slab of cement with a chain link fence surrounding them that's outside. And they used to have basketball courts, but they took them down because somebody climbed up and refused to come down. At least that was at the time. You know, you think about, I think, a 10-foot by 12-foot cell, and that's the person's home for 22 hours. They are in cages when they shower. They're in cages when they go to the law library. But the other thing I noticed, and you certainly can tell that people are, you know, understandably, that their minds are fragmenting from that, right? But the other thing I thought was interesting is even in those kind of stark conditions, people still kind of created their own lives where you could look into their cells. And I remember one guy, like he'd made a chess set that was like the Steelers and the Eagles or something like that, you know, and some of them paint. You know, and not, I'm not trying to say that it's not a bad, it's not a tough life, but it's interesting how even in those kind of conditions there are sort of signs of life. And, you know, the other thing, of course, and I'm always struck by this with in the court system is, you know, a lot of those people are really, really dangerous people. And it's always interesting to me when you see them in those kind of settings. They don't really look dangerous. They look more kind of pathetic.
Mm-hmm. You know, I couldn't have, personally, I couldn't imagine being in that situation. I think I'd want to be executed. You know, I mean, I just could not imagine spending the rest of my life in those kinds of conditions. I don't understand how anybody could adjust to that and be, you know, quote, normal. I guess, I don't know. It's hard for me to imagine. Well, I guess that's part of it, yeah.
It was interesting because Green has a general population too. It's a supermax prison, but it has a population that isn't life, that isn't death row. And so I asked him, well, can I talk to somebody who used to be on death row, who's now in general population? And they took me to this guy, and he kind of reminded me of, if you know the movie Sling Blade, the guy from that. He was, there was definitely something wrong with him, but he said, I'll only talk to you if I could talk to you alone. And so we went off by ourselves. The warden like left the room, and I figured, well, he can't kill me like that quickly, right? If something happens, God, I'll be able to scream or something.
Oh my gosh.
And I remember talking to him, and you know, he actually had a certain nostalgia for being on death row. Cause he was, like I said, there's something wrong with him. But he said, you know, I got left alone and I didn't have to deal with all these other people. And
right,
he, you know, could play his guitar in peace and all that. Huh. And it was kind of an interesting interesting experience.
You're listening to Lehigh Valley Discourse on WDIY, Lehigh Valley Public Radio. Many choices, real voices. Real voice tonight is Riley Yates, a 10-year-plus veteran reporter for the Morning Call, who's beat has been the Northampton County court system, who has seen some of the ugliest aspects of the human condition in his time. I'm Alan Jennings. I'm your host. We are going to take a break. Hope you'll stick around. More to talk about with Riley Yates.
Spread the word about your business or organization to a well-informed audience. Become an underwriter with WDIY. Our lineup of NPR news and locally produced programs reaches thousands of engaged listeners in the Lehigh Valley and beyond. Underwriting on WDIY is an affordable and effective way to provide information about your product and services to people who care. To learn more about underwriting opportunities, 610-694-8100, extension 6, or WDIY.org.
Welcome back. This is Lehigh Valley Discourse on WDIY. I want to thank Neil Heaver over there. Neil is a long-serving guy that's made this radio station possible for a long time. He's the guy that pushes those buttons and does the technical stuff so I don't make a complete fool of myself. My guest tonight is Riley Yates, a guy that I've known probably since about a week after he started here. I remember being interviewed by you. I don't remember what the subject was.
Yeah, I talked to you about I was writing about mortgage foreclosures.
That was
when the housing bubble burst.
That was a big one. Chess. I'm going to lighten the discussion for a few minutes. We'll go back to the darkness. So you got this chess thing going. You're what? Like a national champion? A world champion?
Not even close.
You're not rushing, are
you? I feel a little bit like a high school quarterback who like is harkening back to his good old days.
Well, that's
or something.
Okay. We all.
So I'm a FIDE master of chess, which is like there are three international titles. There's Grandmaster, International Master, and FIDE Master. And how I would define it would be FIDE Master. If you're a Grandmaster and International Master, you're probably good enough to be a professional chess player. FIDE Master is kind of like strong. It kind of means like strong amateur.
Triple A in baseball.
Yeah, something like that maybe. So I became chess obsessed when I was a kid. And I used to study chess, no joke, like 6 hours a day.
Oh, my gosh.
I'd walk to school with a chess book. I'd read a chess book while I was walking to school.
Huh.
I was lucky that I lived five blocks from the Seattle Chess Club. So I would go there every night and play people. And for whatever reason, and I can remember when this happened, I was playing a game I've known how to play chess since I was a kid, since I was before I can remember. Hmm. But
your dad taught you?
My dad taught me, and he.
I guess that's the kind of thing you
too.
Do when you live in a place like Petersburg, Alaska.
But I can remember it. I remember I was playing a game. I was probably about 12 years old, and I thought I could do this for the rest of my life.
Hmm.
And I could have. I still love chess. I haven't competed in a tournament in since I think 2006, maybe. It's been a long time. But
and you can actually get paid to be a chess player.
Yeah. I mean, for someone like me, if I wanted to be a professional chess player, I would have to teach chess. Mm. And one of the things, so when I was 18 years old, I kind of had this decision to make, do I want to try to make a living playing chess or do I want to do something else? And ultimately, I said to myself, well, if I can make a living playing chess, then I probably can make a living doing something else, and I probably can enjoy chess a lot more as an amateur than I ever will as a professional.
Hmm.
But it was something that gave me a lot of opportunity. I got to, in college, I used it as an excuse to travel around the world. So one summer I went and backpacked through Europe and I played in a tournament.
To play chess?
Yeah.
That's cool.
I played in a tournament in Budapest where I spent 3 weeks in Budapest at a hostel called the Yellow Submarine,
nice.
I remember. And then I played in a tournament in Biel, Switzerland, which is the Detroit of watchmakers. It's where, like, Omega is housed.
Hmm.
And, and then, of course, in between, I got to backpack around and, just have a good time.
Fantastic.
The next year, I went to Southeast Asia, and I did the same thing. So I played in a tournament in Kuala Lumpur.
Man.
And then I went to Brunei, of all places. I played in a tournament. The Sultan of Brunei.
Right.
In between, I went to Thailand and Laos and traveled around Borneo and traveled around Malaysia. And so it was something, and it always felt good to say, oh, I'm playing chess because I'm not just some random college kid backpacking by himself through these different areas.
So what do you do now? You just play for fun? Or
yeah.
Do you have anybody who will actually play?
It comes, with me.
Because I wouldn't play with you.
Well, the thing that's amazing is that in today's world, so when I was a kid in the 90s playing, the only way you could really play people was you had to find a chess club. So if you didn't live in a city, you couldn't really be a chess player.
Mm.
And that's why, like, America, New York City has always been the center of chess. And Seattle is a big chess place, but one of the challenges of getting to be to that next level is eventually you have to find other, you have to go someplace else.
Yeah.
What's amazing today now is you can play online, and you can play the best players in the world online.
Right. And don't have to go anywhere.
And don't have to go anywhere. And
you do it in your underwear at the...
So you have now, you know, you have 12-year-old grandmasters who have studied with the help of computers and computer databases. I mean, when I was a kid, you subscribed to chess magazines and you read, you know, the latest moves from a magazine that were delivered once a month. Mm. And, you know, I play more international masters or grandmasters now sitting in my house than I ever had an opportunity to as a player who was trying to be, you know, trying to play competitively.
You're listening us talk about the fascinating life of one Riley Yates, reporter for the Morning Call, who's just finished up a year's run reporting on the morning on the I'm sorry, on the Northampton County court system. Let's go back to the darkness of that subject.
Sure.
Do you have any? I mean, you covered Michael Ballard, arguably the Pennsylvania's almost Pennsylvania's Charles Manson. I mean, the Manson murders really freaked me out when I was in, I guess, high school at the time. And Ballard has got to be a comparable kind of situation. Do you have any thoughts about what causes people to go so far outside the mainstream? I mean, humans are the only species, I think, who can know pain, understand what it means and how it happens, and still inflict it on another human. That just, I don't understand that. And what do you think is, I mean, why, what causes people to do this? Is it a switch that gets flipped? Is it chemical? Is it nature? Is it nurture? I mean, what do you think is your...
Well, one thing that is interesting about death penalty cases is that there's this requirement that they have to research defendants' backgrounds. And it's called mitigation work. And they basically gather all this data about who they were, what they did, you know, essentially they do a whole diagram of their life. And when you sit through those trials, there are a lot of themes that come out. And it's usually people who have really atrocious childhoods.
Right.
Or, you know, they were treated like animals.
So they become victims themselves.
Or
they start as victims.
Yeah. But of course, you know, as prosecutors always point out, there are plenty of people who have those kind of horrible childhoods who don't become mass murderers. Right. And so the answer isn't, it can't be black and white. It's really gray. You certainly have conditions that produce awful things. And, you know, I think we've known that for forever, right? We know that, you know, poverty makes people, you know, makes people into worse people than they might not otherwise be. But you also just have the reality of that there is evil in the world.
Well, that's where I'm going is that, you know, the world that you were reporting in, that you were working in, Bruce Springsteen in the song Nebraska. I mean, I think Nebraska would be like the soundtrack for the kind of world that you were working in and reporting on. And he says, "Sir, there's just a meanness in this world." Is there evil? I mean, are people born evil, or you think it's a combination?
I think that it's a combination. I mean, I'm a bad person to ask if there's evil in the world because I spend so much time looking at it.
Yeah, well,
why
I think.
And that's one thing is I try to remind myself that because if you spend your life in the system, right, you would think that everybody has a drug problem. Everybody, you know, beats their wife. Everybody, right. You know, cheats on their taxes. You know, you'd think that nobody does anything right ever. And that's no more true than having sort of a Pollyannish view of the world, mm-hmm. that everybody does the right thing. You know, I try to remind myself that a lot. You know, I think about if I took up the worldview of what I see day to day, I'd never let my kids walk to school, right? Mm-hmm. And I hope that when my kids get old enough, I'll be comfortable enough in the world to let them walk to school.
Well, I mean, you know, when you think about the difference between our lives as kids, I mean, I used to get up like 6 a.m. I mean, I've been ADHD, I think, for my whole life, I'm sure. And I remember getting up at 6 o'clock and my parents were still asleep. I'd be out playing in the neighborhood. My parents had no idea where I was. They'd call for me at some point to get me to come home for lunch, you know, yell out in the neighborhood, "Alan," you know. And I go back out after lunch and continue and then come home for dinner and then go back out until it got dark. I mean, that was – and they didn't know where I was. I was running around. I was riding my bike all around Lower Macungie Township at, when I was, you know, 10 or 12 years old. Yeah. Today you get run over on Lower Macungie Road. I don't know about that. I know my kids didn't get very far from our watchful eye, you know. It's just such a different world. But I just – you know, for me – I have a hard time with the death sentence in most cases, but I could see myself voting to send somebody to death row. I mean, somebody who is without question guilty of a heinous crime, that there are witnesses, it's indisputable. I don't know what you do with that person. I don't know what good it is leaving them in a cage.
Well, it's interesting that you say that because I interviewed Michael Ballard on four different occasions.
That's got to be chilling.
Before his trial, right after he was sentenced to death, and then twice when he kind of briefly challenged the state to put him to death. And during one of those interviews, I asked him, you know, if you'd sat on that jury, what would you have done? And he's an interesting guy because he's intelligent. He has a certain amount of understanding of, you know, who he is. And he said, I don't have any dispute with the jury's verdict. And so, you know, even the killer himself didn't necessarily disagree with the death sentence.
Yeah, well, it's a tough one. And even people, yeah, I mean, you got the whole so-called pro-life crowd. You know, many of them are anti-abortion, but they're pro-death penalty. And it strikes me as being inconsistent, you know. But it's such a tough world. I admire the fact that you could do this all these years. Now you're out of that beat. You've got you've moved on to new things. What's next for Riley Yates as a reporter?
Well, so I have kind of an investigative reporter role now, where I'm
is that Tim Dyer's old spot?
No, it predates him leaving the paper. It was about, I don't know, maybe 8-9 months ago. And I'm still covering the courts. I mean, I'm still covering criminal justice pretty regularly. But I'm kind of taking a step back from sort of the day-to-day grind, and I can kind of look at more big picture stuff. And every once in a while, you know, I get to do stuff that's totally off topic. I mean, one of the things I said to the editors was I was kind of, you know, I've interviewed so many, like, grieving mothers and, you know, I can remember a couple years ago, like, I was working on the series on the opiate crisis, and I was interviewing all these mothers who had lost their daughters or sons to drug overdoses. And, you know, and in between that, I interviewed the mother of a woman who was murdered by her estranged boyfriend who'd, like, days after she'd gotten a PFA. And it was a case where the police maybe had not been sympathetic enough to her problems. They'd been called to the house before. And, you know, those things weigh on you, and it kind of piles up. And those cases deserve a lot of attention, and they deserve a lot of emotional energy. And if you can't give that, you got to start doing something else.
How often do you fault the police?
I mean, I don't, this sounds strange to say, but it's not really my job to fault the police. I really try to report a story as the voices and as the facts show it. And I try not to dwell a lot on, like, well, if I was in this situation, what would I think? Or if I was an advocate, how would I approach it? Because it's just not my role. And so I'm completely comfortable with just writing a story and letting advocates be the voice of whether it's right or wrong.
But, you know, that there's this societal kind of context in which all of these things occur. And, you know, right now there's a lot of energy in the issue of police brutality toward people of color. And, you know, my politics are pretty much on my sleeve. Everybody knows my politics are pretty progressive to left. But, you know, some of these things, I mean, if I was a cop, I mean, in Lehigh Valley, the guy in South Whitehall who shot the guy who was, you know, climbing on vehicles as they were driving by and spread eagle on the hood of his SUV. And I mean, he was a big hulking bodybuilder kind of a guy. And, you know, just 2 weeks earlier, there was the incident on Route 33 where two cops with tasers couldn't control a big guy.
Yeah, I covered that trial.
Yeah. So, I mean, if I'm that cop in South Whitehall and I've seen that video, you know, two guys able to overcome the cops with tasers, I'd be pretty quick to say, no, don't take another step. Don't make me, you know, shoot you. Now, I guess you could say, what about the taser? But the tasers didn't work on those sure. other two guys. So, you know, I'm sympathetic to cops a lot, even though my politics would suggest otherwise.
Well, there's no question it's a tough job. I mean, just to talk about the trauma, I mean, imagine day in, day out responding to, you know, calls where you're seeing people at their worst, right? It's what's interesting with the South Whitehall shooting is, you know, you see there's disagreement even in the law enforcement community about whether it was right or wrong. I mean,
right.
Jim Martin, I don't think anybody would say he's an enemy of police.
Right.
Right.
But there's still such an amount of energy out there scrutinizing that stuff. You think there's got to be some pressure to, I mean, I don't know, would Jim Martin of 10 years ago have taken that position? You know what I mean? So I think there's societal context that has to be applied to these things. You're listening to Lehigh Valley Discourse on WDIY. My guest is Riley Yates. I'm Alan Jennings. Riley, we're just about out of time, but I want to give you an opportunity to complain about my generation.
Your generation?
Baby boomers.
I mean,
I know you got an issue with us.
No, I don't have an issue with baby boomers. It's what's interesting is it's from the at some you now you have my tongue tied.
I like that.
I think I feel really to speak to the generation after me, to people like my younger sister or my younger brother's age. I feel really bad for them because I think the promise of our society isn't there for them.
And a large part of it is my generation's
And so I think about the cost of going to school and the debt that you have. And, you know, in an ideal world, people would pursue their dreams. And so the things they are passionate about, they would pursue. If the average kid wanted to be an artist and wanted to paint for a living, are they really going to be able to paint for a living
if they leave
school with $200,000 in debt?
Yep. I mean, these kids are graduating with mortgage payments for student loans. I think everybody with a student loan ought to stop paying, put their money in an escrow account, and force a crisis in the system that would finally make the people who can fix this problem get it fixed. I just think it's appalling. We're out of time, Riley. It's been fascinating having a conversation with you. Thanks for being part of the show.
Well, thanks for having me.
I'm Alan Jennings, and I'm your host for tonight's edition of Lehigh Valley Discourse on WDIY, Lehigh Valley Public Radio. Many choices, real voices.